From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Some governments use selective taxes rather than broad-based taxes to fund public pensions. You'll hear from an expert who pans that practice. He believes relying on selective taxes leads to long-term problems for keeping pension plans afloat. North Carolina legislators voted to override the governor's veto. They put in place a voter ID law. You'll hear highlights from their debate. Why did they disagree with the governor about this new constitutional requirement? You'll hear from one national expert who says both conservatives and liberals are wrong when they talk about the government's role in addressing income inequality. This Johns Hopkins University political scientist says both sides need a better grasp of what he calls the captured economy. And we'll discuss the political impact of an investment strategy based on environmental, social, and governance goals. It's called the ESG movement. It could have a negative impact for retired government workers. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
State lawmakers will return to work in Raleigh at the end of January, and at the top of the list of priorities is putting together a new state operating budget. But there are lots of other issues likely to be on the table as well as the months go by, along with a new political dynamic. More Democrats having been elected to seats in November. Carolina Journal will be covering all the action. Rick Henderson, of course, is the editor-in-chief. He joins me now with a preview. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
Let's talk first about the big issues. We know they have to put together a new operating budget, so that will occupy a lot of the time. Other things that you think are going to become items that perhaps they can agree on or perhaps have a contentious debate over?
Well, there are going to be a lot of different tracks running parallel here. First of all, there is the issue of redistricting, both for the congressional districts and for the legislative districts that are going to have to happen under court order in time for the 2020 election cycle. And we don't know yet. They're probably not going to take up the congressional districts right away because the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to the case in North Carolina and the case in Maryland.
U.S. Supreme Court.
And so because they have agreed to hear those, we're going to probably have arguments in a matter of weeks and a decision, perhaps not until June when the court leaves for the summer. So that way there's going to be really no guidance from the court before they still have to redraw districts. And so, I mean, it's not just a matter of, well, we don't know if we're going to have to draw them or not. Yes, they're going to have to draw the districts, but at least at the congressional level, it's quite possible that it will be July or August before they can even figure out what they're supposed to do.
Would have to then redraw these districts. But in 2020, after the new census,
yes,
then the whole process has to start over again.
And with Congress, we know or we're almost certain that we're going to gain a congressional seat because of population increases that have taken place over the past two decades. We almost got one after the 2010 census. We didn't quite get there. We're definitely going to get one of the 2020 census. So there's going to be a lot of jumbling, at least at the congressional level. The legislative level, they're not going to change the number of seats, but they are going to have to redraw the districts again for one cycle only.
Fair to say that once there is some sort of guidance and the legislature takes up the issue of drawing the lines, that there's going to be a big old fight?
Yes, there's going to be a big fight about it. And it's probably going to occupy the time of the people who are directly involved in the drawing process. Typically, though, those are some of the top people in the General Assembly. I mean, David Lewis, Harnett County, the Republican, the chairman of the Rules Committee, is the top man on redistricting in the House. And he's the person who basically manages the House calendar. So he's going to be sort of out of action when they're doing this. And so this is the sort of thing where the senior members of each chamber in both parties are going to be involved in this process, and that will take up a lot of time. But again, something that's not likely to happen until the summer.
I want to talk a little bit more about what you see coming in terms of budget negotiations. But to get there, we have to talk first about the fact that there is a major new political dynamic in the General Assembly. It was a very good election cycle for Democrats in November. They won a lot of seats. So the Republicans still have majorities in both chambers, but those supermajorities are gone.
Right.
So what does that mean for discussion about all sorts of things?
Well, there are now 10 more Democrats in the House than there were last time. So the dynamic now is 55-45. 65-55. I left 10 people out. 65-55.
They won't appreciate that.
They won't. That's right. In the Senate, there are 6 more Democrats than before. So we're in a situation in which there's not a veto-proof majority in either chamber. And so they're, well, they sort of said, as they rolled their eyes and held their noses at the end of December, well, we're going to have to work with you people next year. And they didn't seem to sound very enthusiastic about the thought of doing that. There's a big safety valve here for the General Assembly, and that is a few years ago, a law was passed which basically said that if we don't have a new budget on time at the end of the fiscal year, we can continue operating with the budget that was in place previously and using the spending and using existing revenues to get there. And so long as tax collections keep pace with spending needs, then this budget battle could go on long beyond June 30th when the fiscal year ends and the new one begins. And before that happened, previously, you could have a government shutdown, or you could have, because your budget would go away completely. It's not as if you could pass a continuing resolution as Congress does, or as the General Assembly can in the odd, you know, in the even numbered years, because the budget just goes away at the end of this fiscal year. They've now given themselves a safety valve, which probably means that this thing could stretch well into the summer or fall.
With so many more Democrats elected to the legislature, does that mean that Democrat Governor Roy Cooper will have more influence?
Yeah, he'll have to. I mean, he will, well, put it this way, he will choose to. He doesn't have to. He will choose to do that. And where that means a difference is that probably there will be a big push to either eliminate some of the tax cuts that have been phased in over the years, to perhaps add a new tier to get away from the flat tax we have right now, potentially to add different forms of taxation, to do things also on the spending side. There are going to be moves to do things to rein in school choice, which may have something to do with reducing funding for opportunity or disability scholarships, or even perhaps, requiring charter schools to have, new, mandates for service, which will then penalize them to the benefit of traditional district schools. There's going to be a lot of things that he's going to try to do at the margins to make life difficult for Republicans and for the sort of freedom-oriented, growth-oriented policies we've had over the past few sessions.
Ever since the governor was elected and on the campaign trail as well, he talked a lot about the issue of delivering health care and health insurance. He wants to expand Medicaid. And so far, North Carolina is a state that has chosen not to do that. Are we going to see that push again?
Of course, we are. And there are a few Republicans, Representative Donnie Lambeth for Scythe County is one of them, his former hospital executive, and the hospitals are going to push very hard for Medicaid expansion, because if that happens, hospitals tend to qualify for higher reimbursement levels. And so that's what they like. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a good thing for some private practitioners, especially for practitioners who aren't affiliated with a big hospital network. So, I mean, it's not there are always trade-offs involved. And the big trade-off here is not only would the existing pot of money be moved around differently, even if a lot of it initially comes from Washington, not from us, although it all comes from us.
Right.
But there will be winners and losers if there's Medicaid expansion. And also there's, of course, some evidence, peer-reviewed evidence indicating that people who are on Medicaid actually have worse outcomes than people who don't receive Medicaid benefits. So there's the patients who have to be considered too, but quite often they're the ones who get left out in this.
Rick, I know that Carolina Journal is going to be literally covering this daily, and we know that the printed version is a monthly newspaper, but the daily news site, Rick, CarolinaJournal.com, you're going to have continual updates. Give us a sense of the topics and the people you're going to be covering.
We're going to be doing a lot with education issues, as we always do, both higher education and K-12 education. An issue that we've covered very thoroughly is the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and that controversy. Potential movement on eminent domain and property rights issues, which is a perennial for us. And then, of course, tax and budget. I mean, who pays and where's the money going? And that's something that we'll always keep up with.
The end of January, those state lawmakers do come back into session in Raleigh. Carolina Journal will be there every day covering this for us at carolinajournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal, news stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv, and the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many governments assess so-called sin taxes on items such as alcohol and tobacco. Do these taxes represent good public policy? A recent panel discussion tackled that topic. The event was co-hosted by the John Locke Foundation, Western Carolina University's Center for the Study of Free Enterprise, and the Federalist Society, and we're interviewing panelists to get their take on the issue. In this segment, we welcome Dr. Thad Calabrese, Associate Professor at New York University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, we're going to get into the specifics of a chapter that you co-wrote for a book on this topic titled For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. But before we get into the specifics of your chapter, in general, your sense of sin taxes and whether they represent good public policy.
It's sort of imposing an ideal of what behavior you think you want from people as opposed to allowing people to make their own decisions. From that perspective and the distortionary effects it has on the behavior of people, I don't find them to be an extraordinarily enlightened form of taxation.
Yeah, so generally the sense that this is not the best way to go. Your specific chapter in this book dealt with the use of these taxes dealing with pensions.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
So my chapter is a little bit of the oddball of the book in that it's not necessarily directed at sin taxes per se, but the chapter focuses on the use of selective taxes. Now, ironically or incidentally is probably the correct word, some of those taxes are sin taxes that are used to fund pensions. But the bulk of the chapter focuses on an increasing phenomenon in state and local governments who have underfunded pension systems, significantly underfunded. These are not pension systems that are mildly underfunded, such as North Carolina's pension systems, which are actually quite healthy, comparatively speaking. These are pension systems that are in risk in many cases of running out of money in a few years. And when you think of the intergenerational equity of what that means, it means that prior generations received benefits that they didn't pay for, and that the benefits now have to be paid for by taxpayers who did not receive the benefits. It also means that taxpayers who may be interested in pension reform have a problem. So if North Carolina tomorrow wanted to switch from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, there might be a little bit of fiscal pain. Pension systems are somewhere around over 90% funded. So there's a small liability that would have to be somehow paid off. But if you were in Illinois and wanted to close the pension system, you would need tens of billions of dollars. And so it effectively, the underfunding effectively removes many significant reform possibilities from current and future taxpayers, which I think is a real problem. The issue of selective taxes with pensions is interesting because, as I said, it tends to be the cities and the states that have not managed their pension systems well. I look specifically at in depth the states of Pennsylvania and Illinois. Obviously, whenever you mention Illinois and fiscal management and health in the same breath, you know you're in for quite the story. But in the case of Pennsylvania, allows municipalities to have their own pension systems. They have thousands of local pension systems. And the state for over 100 years has had a system where commercial insurers pay a premium tax to the state, and then the state distributes the money to the localities, and it's intended to offset the pension contributions of the cities in Pennsylvania. And so what you have is a system where the state was basically collecting money, then sending it to the cities, and there was no connection between the benefits and the financing of the benefits. And so obviously, if you were a city that was funding the pension system, or I'm sorry, providing benefits that were lower than the maximum amount the state would pay you back for, essentially, you had an incentive to increase benefits to your workforce because it was essentially free. And now you're in a situation where you have systems that are well underfunded, and so then they start doing things like taxing, increasing the sales tax, increasing the a garbage collection tax, as another example. Philadelphia, for example, they were supposed to use a tax on soda as part of their pension funding arrangement. And I might be mistaken, I might be misremembering, as they say. I believe they also at one point had a cigarette tax that was supposed to be devoted to their pension system. None of those taxes generated the revenue they suspected, so their poorly funded pension system continued to be poorly funded.
We are chatting with Dr. Thad Calabrese, who's associate professor at New York University, and talking about the use specifically of these specialized selective taxes to help with pension funds. This seems to fit in with the general theme of how these taxes are distorting proper tax policy. When these governments do or take these sort of steps, what kinds of long-term problems does this create?
The selective taxation is usually done as a means of addressing poor management and poor behavior over the past several decades. Either the benefits that are far out of line with affordability and sustainability, or with the unwillingness to levy taxes at a rate that would properly fund the pensions. There's a debate about what properly funding pensions means. My particular opinion is that pensions should be fully funded by the people who are consuming the services of the government. That would imply, as I said, that if future generations and future taxpayers wanted to make changes to these systems, they would not be on the hook for money that prior generations failed to put into the system. The history or the experiences with selection taxation have shown, I show in the chapter, have generally not resulted in better funded pension systems. Because the reality is, if you are going to place a fee or a tax on some particular service or good, and you're not going to also reform and address benefit levels, you're basically just throwing dirt into a deeper and deeper hole, and you're not making any progress. So the allure of of these taxes is that it can provide some kind of way out of these problems without making a very difficult decision and without having difficult negotiations about whether benefits are excessive, proper, et cetera. So that's no one who's implemented these. I shouldn't say no one. There are very few examples of municipalities that have done this where they have improved their pension funding.
Dr. Thad Calabrese, associate professor at New York University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Despite a veto from Governor Roy Cooper, North Carolina lawmakers have approved a law implementing the new constitutional mandate for a photo voter ID. Republican Joyce Kravitz led the state Senate vote to override Cooper's veto.
The governor has made it clear all along that he opposed a photo voter ID. But on November 6, we had clear direction from the voters of North Carolina. And we have done our duty by passing this bill to implement the voter ID that they instructed us to do. From the time this bill was introduced, we made 30-something changes. We listened to everybody. There isn't anyone who can say that all sides didn't participate. We took guidance, suggestions, amendments from colleagues on the other side of the aisle, from stakeholders, from our colleges, universities, community colleges. We listened to everyone. We tried to incorporate the changes that they recommended, that they asked for, because we don't want anyone to be disenfranchised. We don't want anyone to not be able to vote. So I think we've covered just about everything that we could have covered. And I believe it's a good bill.
Democratic Senator Ben Clark voted for the original voter ID bill, but he sided with the governor on the veto.
I voted for the bill to leave the Senate during the first time around. When I voted in favor of it, I was pretty optimistic that we were going to get where we needed to get. And oftentimes when we vote on bills, it's with the expectation that further improvement will take place and that we will eventually get to where we want to be. But unfortunately, I don't believe we're quite there yet. We've come a long way. It's better than the bill that was approved in 2013. It's better than the bill that showed up in the Elections Committee about a month or so ago. But it is not quite ready yet.
Republican Senator Jerry Tillman responded to Clark and other critics, especially those who think voter ID suppresses votes.
In Georgia, when voter ID was implemented, minority participation increased, voter participation increased, and in the 34 states that now have it, most of those states' voter participation increased because they have confidence that their vote will no longer be stolen by an illegal vote. The governor, he's got pollsters running around out there now trying to tell him which way to go on this thing. The best poll you could ever have was on November the 6th when almost 56% of the voters said, yeah, we want it. They want it.
Most lawmakers agreed with those voters and with Tillman. They rejected Governor Cooper's veto and approved a law to implement voter ID. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Much of our political debate revolves around left versus right, more government versus less government. During a recent speech at Duke University, Stephen Tellis offered a different perspective. Tellis is a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. He's co-author of the book, The Captured Economy. Tellis says organized elites are using government to lock in their economic advantages.
Markets will increasingly determine the status of the less wealthy, but politics will determine that of the more advantaged. This would predict exactly the increase in income and wealth at the top and the atrophying of it at the bottom that we've seen over the last 40 years. So what are the predictions of this theory? One is that in the absence of disruptions to the system of political organization, economic growth will slow down, right? If we believe with Schumpeter that that creative destruction is the basic motor of economic growth, right? That, and the ability to tear down existing business models, tear down existing firms that have gotten calcified and replace them with entirely new business models, entirely new products, right? That process is, and the speed with which it operates is the key to economic growth. But the more we see this rent seeking, especially at the top, the more that's going to slow down. Second, social mobility will decline as the organized lock in their advantage through state action while the disorganized cannot. Third, inequality will increase over time as rents generated by organization at the top of the social system increase. those rents will then be redistributed into political organization, those excess profits. One thing you could do with those excess profits is you can take them and invest them back into the political system to either expand your rents or protect them from attack.
So what does Stephen Tellis think we should do?
The basic argument here is that rent seeking is fundamentally a political problem. It's a result of inadequate political competition in order to drive economic competition. In the absence of effective political competition, what you get is increasing economic oligopoly. So what could we do about that? And the argument we make in the book is that you need deliberation, right? That in general, rent seeking is a failure of effective deliberation.
One option Tellis puts forward, subsidies for opposing arguments in a political debate.
Most areas where there's things that we generally characterize as rents have a political environment in which there's a lot of organization on one side and nothing on the other, right? So you see things like congressional hearings where all the people are arguing for one position. And it goes all the way down to town councils making development decisions where everybody is against building that new apartment building in town and nobody is on the other side. It's an environment in which there's not going to be deliberation, right? You don't actually have to make persuasive arguments to policymakers if there's nobody arguing on the other side. So the basic argument we make is what would be pro-deliberative mechanisms? What would be mechanisms that would both put information in front of policymakers about the cost of these rent-seeking arrangements, and that would give them some pressure to do something about it? Well, one, we argue, is subsidized countervailing power. Right? If the problem is unbalanced organization, right? All the organization is on the side of rent seekers and there's no organization on the other. Well, in our democratic society, we have evidence of the kind of thing that can do something about that.
That's Professor Stephen Tellis of Johns Hopkins University speaking recently at Duke. He's discussing key themes from his book, The Captured Economy. Tellis offers one example of outside groups helping to inform a political debate.
Until recently, in almost every jurisdiction in the country, teachers' unions were likely to be enormously represented whenever any political decision was being made on schools, and almost nobody was organized on the other side, right? And that made the path of least resistance to do what teachers wanted and allowed them often to extract rents from the political process in the form of not so much actually increasing salaries, but decreasing pressures on low performers. Again, one thing we had in the United States is we do have this enormous, these enormous foundations, and they've actually invested in a lot of money into creating countervailing power in the form of pro-education reform organizations that are able to show up in Hartford, Connecticut, or Baltimore, Maryland, or DC, or New York City, and make sure that policymakers have information on both sides of these questions. And that has turned out to have an enormous effect, whether you think good or ill, but it's had an enormous effect on the politics of that area as well.
Tellis offers another idea for improving the current status of political debates.
Increasing legislative and executive information capacity. One of the most powerful tools that rent seekers have is the absence of information on the other side. Right? And one way to get that is from the outside, creating new external organizations. But the other thing is to make government less dependent for its information on outside sources.
Tellis offers another suggestion.
Change the rules of the game, in particular the involvement of general purpose actors, right? So one of the things is almost all these areas of capture are a result of the fact that you have special purpose government entities, right, that turn out to be very easily captured by those they regulate, whether that's in finance with the Securities and Exchange Commission or the FDA with drug companies, right? One thing you can do is increase the involvement of general purpose government entities that have an interest in efficiency broadly understood, right? And so one example of this is OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, has an office called the Office of Independent Regulatory Authority, right? I think that's right. And what they do is they create central review of all major regulations, right? And so even though a entity may get capture over a regulatory agency on its own that still has to be, they still have to convince OMB that it passes the test of a cost-benefit analysis.
Telus says the judicial branch could play an enhanced role.
We argue in the book for a much more, what you might think of as pro-deliberative role for courts, right? Not necessarily striking down regulatory regimes like this on the basis of economic freedom, but saying if you're going to do that, if you're going to regulate and allow the dentist to set their own salaries, legislators need to put their hand on it. And they need to do it over and over again, right, to authorize that this is what they want rather than simply passing this on to unaccountable regulatory boards.
Telus also urges people to think beyond left versus right or more government versus less government.
In order to, in a way, go at this huge mass of upward redistributing regulations, we need to think in new ideological terms, right? Almost all of our last 40 years of American politics have been characterized by a left versus right on the question of whether we should have more government or less, right? And whether we should have more inequality or less, right? That's been the axis of political competition, right? But the thing that's characteristic of all the issues I've talked about before is none of them are really squarely on the side of more or less government, right? That is, liberals generally tend to be in favor of government activism and against constitutional or other kinds of constraints on government action. But part of the argument of this book is lots of the inequality we've got as a result of an absence of constitutional constraints in some ways on government. And simultaneously, conservatives need to get more upset about inequality, especially if they realize how much of inequality is not a result of the absence of government, but its presence.
That's political science professor Stephen Telus of Johns Hopkins University speaking recently at Duke. He shared themes from his book, The Captured Economy. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. More than 820,000 North Carolinians participate in North Carolina's state pension plan. Now, for current and future government employees, this plan is an important component of their retirement plans. That's why the investment strategy is evaluated closely for its returns and potential risks. Now, a growing number of states are employing the use of what's called ESG in public investments. And that has John Locke Foundation Senior Fellow Don Vandervaart cautioning North Carolina to take steps to protect pension plan participants from that risk. Don joins us now to talk about exactly what it is and why he's so concerned. Don, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what is ESG?
ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance issues, and the investment strategy it describes taking these factors into account in making your investment decisions. Proponents claim that there are certain areas where investors should be cautioned against investing, for example, tobacco companies, gun companies, gun manufacturers, fossil fuel energy companies, with the idea that, there's long-term liabilities associated with these industries, and you need to be staying away from them. Now, opponents claim that, look, we're investment managers. that we do this for our living. We take these liabilities into account, and so we don't need any additional parameters imposed upon us. We may be violating our fiduciary responsibility.
Fiduciary responsibility meaning that if someone's investing your money, they have an obligation to look out for you to make sure there's returns.
And in fact, the obligation is to maximize your returns. And by these opponents argue by artificially limiting their ability to make investment decisions, they may be failing in that fiduciary responsibility by failing to realize maximum returns. And that's what went on in California.
Let's talk about California in just a moment, because I know it caught your eye and you wanted to talk about this. But does North Carolina have an investment strategy for its pension plan that considers all of these elements when it invests?
In fact, there is a statutory framework that our treasurer is subject to. And currently, our treasurer is Dale Falwell. And he was asked about this on national TV. He was on Squawk Box, I think it's called. And
that's a CNBC program.
I think that's right. And he was asked specifically, where is North Carolina on considering these ESG factors? And Secretary Falwell correctly, in my mind, responded he doesn't think about them. He has got his fiduciary responsibility, and that's what he will adhere to. The statutory scheme was amended in 2009 to actually allow the state treasurer to consider what they called collateral benefits, but essentially were non-investment factors in making investment decisions on behalf of the pension plan. Now, thankfully, it appears Secretary Falwell is not
– Treasurer Falwell.
Treasurer Falwell, sorry, is not following that.
But it is possible that future treasurers could take advantage of that element of the statute.
Absolutely. And I think it would be prudent just to remove that part of the statute to make it clear.
Speaking of prudence and the potential risks, should a future state treasurer decide to follow that or include that in the investment strategy, that takes us to the state of California, where they actually have been involved in that. Tell us what's happening there.
Right. California, by many metrics, would be considered a very progressive state. However, the CalPERS, which is the California Pension Fund, has for quite a while taken ESG factors into account. And most recently, the president, who was a staunch supporter of ESG investment strategies, was ousted by a policeman, and the policeman ran on the platform of not following these ESG factors. And he pointed out, for example, that a prohibition in CalPERS investing in, for example, tobacco companies caused an $8 billion loss to the fund. So what's apparent is that as progressive as California might be, it comes with a price tag, and
that caught the pensioners' attention.
And he won. He ousted this very prominent ESG proponent because I guess $8 billion and other losses are just too much to bear.
Do we know, Don, if this is a trend towards this type of investing across the country, or are pension investment companies and those accountable for it, are they pulling back?
There appears to be a push, and of course my area is in environmental renewables, that sort of thing. There seems to be a push that since President Trump took office and his de-emphasis, perhaps, as opposed to, for example, Hillary Clinton's policies, his de-emphasis on renewables has led some fund managers, notably some big name investors, to push harder on fund managers to take into account ESG factors, specifically getting away from fossil fuel energy companies, for example.
Now, since we now know, based on your research on this, that it is possible for a future North Carolina treasurer to employ this as part of the investment strategy, even though the current treasurer, Dale Falwell, says he does not, what do we do next in order to protect pensioners from this? It sounds potentially risky.
It is. And a simple removal of that provision that was added in 2009 will return the statutory framework to one that is purely geared toward the fiduciary responsibility, that is, maximizing returns for the retirees. And I think that's clean, and I think that's what Treasurer Falwell is pursuing, and I think it's the right answer.
Is there an appetite to even get into this at the General Assembly? I mean, you're talking about, in some ways, kind of complex information that is of a financial nature. There's all sorts of things for legislators to try to learn about, a lot of new people coming in to the session. Is it possible to think that this would get their attention?
Well, I think the example in California is a very instructive one. And let's hope that when more folks find out about it, that they'll consider it.
And in fact, there are some employee groups or groups that advocate for state employees and state retirees. One would think that they would certainly take an interest in this.
I would hope so.
We've been talking with Don Vandervaart. He is a senior fellow in environmental studies for the John Locke Foundation. He is the former secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, now a senior fellow here at the Locke Foundation. You can read all of his work on a variety of issues at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Don Vandervaart, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.